Dick. And so now, it's my honor to introduce tonight's speaker. Her name is Jeanette A., and she came all the way from Monterey. Hey! Her favorite A slogan is, keep it simple, stupid. That's what she told me, anyways. And she has a sobriety date of April 5th, 2010. We'd like to welcome Jeanette A. from Monterey.
Hi. Keep it simple, stupid. Yes, my name is Jeanette. I'm a recovered alcoholic and all the way from Monterey. My original sobriety date was November 9th, 2009. I say was because I want to say to you that I had a relapse, and I find it very important to tell you why and what I learned from that. But the one that is sticking is April 5th, 2010. So what it was like for me is that I didn't start drinking until I was 35. But that doesn't mean that everything was okay. It just means that is the thing that I chased in life for answers and solutions. Before I turned to alcohol, I was an overachiever. I sought my refuge and my solutions in high grades, honors, degrees, careers, jobs, until I couldn't keep up with it anymore. I also loved to play the director of my life and other people's lives, and that's talked about in the big book. Very, very relieving to me when I learned I could step off of that podium and say, I don't have to do this anymore. I turned to alcohol. I came from a line of alcoholics for centuries. And I, of course, as many of us have probably said before, I am not going to be like my or like, and I did. And because I had used up all my options. And what I didn't know is that what was driving me in my early years that helped me survive was not the same things that were really working in an adult life. And that was self-control, self-reliance, and using my own will to barge my way through life. And I was a very unhappy soul, and I didn't know it. I thought I could just climb another mountain and get another degree, move somewhere else, geographics. And for a while that worked, until it didn't. That sounds like alcoholism, but I hadn't started drinking yet. I started drinking because I made a really bad decision in 1995. And on the on my still being in the driver's seat, and I entered into a marriage that I should have never entered into. And I did that because I was about what I looked like. It was everything out on the surface. But nobody really knew who I was in the inside, and I didn't know either. And I hung in there until probably right after we said I do, and I was quite baffled when I ended up spending the honeymoon at the bar with the guys drinking Mai Tais. And I thought, okay, red flag. Is that an indication that this is not going to go well? And it didn't. I do have a wonderful daughter out of that situation. And from 1997, my world started to slowly unravel as I was trying to hang on like moss on the side of a pond. And I had never felt that sensation before. I was always able to will somebody into something or control something or pray myself into something, and nothing was working. And I don't think I had crossed the invisible line there that I would call alcoholism, but I did start turning to alcohol, and I thought, you know, I think once I get this person I married under control, then I'll stop drinking, because that person's a real, like, what is wrong with you? And but in the meantime, as I said, things were falling apart. I quit my job. This is the best job I'd ever had in my life, because I wanted to make this person happy, and I thought I could direct that. And before we knew it, I hit another level, I guess, in my drinking. I was living in Arizona, moved to California. Things will be better. I'll just change jobs, and I'll help fix this person over here, and then we'll be a happy couple, right? Didn't work. I got more miserable, started drinking pretty regularly at once, and I thought, controlled, right? I'll just get a job at Fresno State. That's what I'll do. So that's what I did. Still unhappy. And I had no idea that I was just slipping. It's like slipping into this coma of what the big book talks about, the spiritual malady. I didn't know that. And I was trying to grasp hard at that time what to do. And then I had a daughter in 2002, and then I had another. I was able to stop drinking because I was going to have a baby. Isn't that the responsible thing to do, is to not drink? And that's what I thought. And so I didn't crave alcohol. I thought, oh, I can just stop. No jitters, nothing like that. And then I looked at my life without numbing myself with alcohol, and I did not want to go back to that house. So I started drinking even more. And I thought, I can't. I have a baby. And so that's when the hiding of the alcohol started. And I'm sure if I look back on the whole movies that I haven't looked at since then, there would probably be a margarita everywhere I went. So it was like baby over here, margarita over here. And I really have everything under control, except for this jerk that I married. And, you know, that person's going to change. And it didn't happen. And I had a pretty sick baby for about 3 years. And that really took me for a tailspin. I didn't know how to. I did the best I could as a mother. And because of her illness and the stress of that, that just drove me. So it didn't matter, you know, it's your circumstances here. So that's my story. And I started drinking more and more. And finally, I absolutely couldn't take it anymore. And I said, I am going to resign from yet another great job I had, and I'm going to get another degree in a totally different area. I don't care if it's in Miami, Florida. And I had no idea I was starting to go crazy then. So I flew back and forth to Miami, Florida for almost 4 years, twice a month. I didn't know what I was doing, as I was chasing again. And when I got bumped up to first class and they said, would you like free? Everything's free. I'm like, bring it on. I said, I'll get the degree. I'll go back. I'll get my girl and life will be great. And it wasn't. And I just drank on the plane. I made sure I wasn't drinking during midterms and finals. And I was semi-controlled. I don't know if that's even a word or possible. But at some point, I crossed the line, and I couldn't wait. Clock watching, covering up, something that says, I don't know, 7-Up had something in it. Everything that was earlier red. I tried this instead of that, and that instead of this. And it was crazy. I would be up in the air in an airplane in first class downing vodka, and you'd think, wow, what a life. But crying under a blanket, thinking, this doesn't make sense. And I didn't know that there could actually be something called insanity that I didn't escape, that runs in my family. And finally, I got through graduation. This is 2009, and I was studying for a national board exam, and I thought, you know what, I think I shouldn't drink while I'm studying for this national licensing. Wouldn't that be a good idea? And then I was, but I could not stop, and I thought, what is this? I had no more control over it at all. And I had to have it. I was hiding it even more. That's all I thought of. And I was an unemployed student at the time, so they're part of what my student loans pay for. Little does the government know that, but now they do, maybe. And I got a great job in a new field. And I thought I was on top of the world, and I swore alcohol off. I was not going to drink. I have this new beginning. I was finally going through divorce. So what if I was going through bankruptcy? Here comes the wreckage, right? Bankruptcy, divorce. My health was failing, and I didn't know because I numbed it with alcohol. And I lost my house. I lost everything, and I was living from relatives from one person to the next till I couldn't stand their habits. And I couldn't stand their habits, and I would move my girl back and forth, and that was crazy. So now she's on this ping-ponging with me, and I'm trying to stop drinking, and I can't. And I thought, oh, I'll just drink at noon before my ethical dilemma, which is quite hilarious when I think about it, is, oh, I won't drink until 5. Then it became 2. And I could not figure out, okay, if I drink at noon, why do I have to have a drink at 12:30? Why am I craving another one at 1, then 1:30? But this time, I've had a whole bottle of vodka by 5. You'd think with the degrees and what I've done, and I don't mean that in a glorious way, that I would be able to figure this out. This disease does not care who we are, what we're doing, when. It is waiting, as it says, it's patient, and it baffled me, and it's very patient. And I was able to stop a little bit, and the next time I got a drink, it just grabbed me and pulled me in. And like they said, it did something for me until it started doing something to me. And I woke up one morning, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I said, I think I'm dying. I am dying, like physically. But then I looked in my eyes, and there was nothing there. It was like a ghost. And I really did not know what to do. And that's my pride. You think after coming through a line of alcoholics, I would know about Alcoholics Anonymous, but then maybe not. Did they go? I don't think so. Did they stay stopped? Did they have solutions? No. So I didn't know what to do, and I couldn't turn to a family who would know. And finally, I started drinking earlier and then coffee with liquor until I was caught on the job. And I thought I was all suave and they would never look and find. I was working with children with disabilities. When I think of that, I'm thinking, oh my gosh. And for a district in this area, a name, and I got called to the front office. And I thought, oh, they're going to tell me how great I am. And I walked in, and there was this HR person from the district and the principal, and they were not smiling. And I still didn't get it. I reeked of whiskey. Okay, so, you know, vodka, people aren't supposed to smell, right? It's real smart to just all have whiskey. Some Bailey's in my coffee, no one will know. That'll tide me over till noon. I got till 9 o'clock. In the morning, and they said, teachers have reported that you've been drinking. No, not me. Fumes coming pouring out of my mouth, red eyes. They said, really? Okay. Would you think you'd be able? And I said, well, how would they know that? Of course, I got defensive. Had to defend my friend, right? Alcohol and or foe. And they said, well, More than one person has reported odd behavior on your part. And I thought, 9 o'clock, how could it be odd already? It's not even noon. If they called me in at noon, okay, this is fair. So they called me. I was sitting there, and I started to smell myself. I was like, oh, this is not good. And he said, you are wobbling when you walk. You are slipping off of the hallways, and when you're working with the kids, you're falling over. And I thought, who? He said, that's you. So have you been drinking? And I thought, there's no way in hell I'm going to tell them, because I'm going to start, I'm going to determine my stop date. I didn't know that day. That was on the 6th of November, 2009. And they said, can you drive yourself home? And I'm like, of course I can. And they said, hand us the keys. I'm like, what do you think I am? 11? And they drove me home. And they drove me to my dad's house. Yeah, I was acting 11. Not that that's a bad thing, but, gosh, 49 years old, being driven home to my dad's house, and I walked in, I don't know where he was, and I sat in his recliner, and I thought, what just happened? I will talk my way out of this. I can do it. And finally, I just said, no, I can't. So I called my boss, and I told him. And I was very honest, because I wanted to keep my license and control things. I said, I'm going to beat the school district to it. I'm going to tell him. So I told him, and he was very understanding. I thought I was in a rehab, actually, in about 3 days. And I went to Southern California somewhere. I'm so out of it. I can't even remember the name of the hospital. And I was also on a benzodiazepine. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's so many crossovers. Because of some psychiatric blessings that I inherited as well, which also I think caused the root of my drinking at the time. But I ended up in an acute wing of a psychiatric hospital, and I was cold turkey alcohol, That went okay. I mean, I had the blessing of the craving removed instantly. Probably fear. That works too. But God removed that, but I got cold turkeyed off of Klonopin. Very dangerous. It's been mixed with alcohol for years. And I got so sick for 7 days, and at the probably a level of stroke. And that was a wild 7 days. But I made it by the grace of God. And then I spent 3 weeks out in the desert somewhere in Lancaster, I think, and in a recovery home that was like a lockdown unit. And I thought, what did I do to get here? I'm in charge. I'm better than these people around me. But why are they happier than me? And I'm not getting this. And finally, I was introduced to the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we looked at this every day, and the goal of the recovery home was to get me through my fourth step in 3 weeks. That's pretty fast. I mean, some people can do it, but it takes to put your life, or to have God put you in the hands of someone that can get you through four steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in 3 weeks. To be really, I think, appointed, or I don't know what the word was, but it was kind of like, this is your exit interview. What are the four steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? So I got through the four steps. I got through the first part of the fourth step, and then they released me out into the world. And they said, before you can go, I want you to list 100 things that you really have resentments about. And I was like, oh my gosh, and think far as back as you can. I said, but we're going to do this, we're going to dig in, and I'm going to find out why those people made me drink. And so I started writing, and I was the studious kind, and I was going to get a diploma or something. I don't know what I thought, but I was not getting it. I was not getting something. I got out, and then I did a geographical for 3 months and then came back here to Visalia. And I got a sponsor. I was still clean, I was still sober, and I really, really worked. I started the steps all over again. I had that plug in the jug. I wasn't drinking, and I was doing what my sponsor told me. I was going to tons of meetings. They said 90 meetings in 90 days. I did 1,000 in 30. And part of that is because I wanted this badly. But still, something was missing. I didn't know what it was. I wasn't used to hearing it in the rooms. Either I wasn't hearing it or it wasn't being said. And I got really sick again. I ended up at Korea Delta Hospital here in intensive care unit for 5 days. My electrolytes had bottomed out. It was almost like, again, like I had a stroke. They'd never to this day have found out what had happened to me. And during that whole time, locked up in ICU with nothing to hurt myself with, I was going batty. I had some supporters from AA come in and visit me and just say, you know, if you memorize the third step prayer, then it's going to be all right. Or, you know, fake it till you make it. And I said, that's what got me here, was I've been faking it all my life. I had to say that because I can't fake it. I couldn't fake it anymore. And they would look at me like, oh, my God, what happened? Did you relapse? And I said, not yet. But, you know, in my head, I was going there. I was working the steps. It was solid. I was going through my fourth step, and the sponsor I had at the time was, you know, and she was hearing the fifth as we were doing this, and we're going to work on your character defects, and you're going to go out there, and you're going to help others. And I thought, they do not want what I have. I can't give them anything right now because there's something missing. Something. I can feel it. I can feel it. I can feel it. There's a darkness, and it's not my depression. I got out of the hospital. In the 5 days I was there, all I ever thought about was, I don't want to drink. I don't have a craving to drink. And I'm not going to go back to drinking, but I haven't figured out what it is that I'm missing. And I went to all kinds of meetings. I talked to all kinds of people. And all I did was plot how I was going to end my life. So that was my solution. And I got out, and I went back to my dad's house, where the place that I could stay, and incomprehensible demoralization. I thought I'd had a bottom when they found me at work. My bottom was thinking outside those windows, if this is all there is to sobriety, I don't want it. Because I don't know what it is supposed to be. I had no pink clouds. This does get better. Happier. But I was trying to convey to you that this disease, it will eat you alive or dead. And I was walking down the path to death. So I actually had not only suicidal ideation, but I had a plan. And I practiced it, and I practiced it, and I practiced it. And then I thought, I don't have the courage to do this. I'll drink. That's what I'll do. But I don't want to drink. I don't want to die drunk. My pride wouldn't let me do that. I spent 3 hours in Rite Aid going over and over, okay, what alcohol? This is like the Last Supper. I'm going to enjoy this and then die. Sanity. And so I went to the drink of my choice, and I drank almost that whole bottle. That should have done something to me. It did nothing. I was so mad. I thought, wait a minute, people go out and they talk about how fun it is. You know, I'm using all of this insane thinking. What I learned that night is that when God removed the craving, He also removed the ability for alcohol to work in my system. And I kept drinking and I kept drinking and waiting for the courage or the, I don't know, something to, the fear to go. And then I would follow through and the end, and she lived happily ever whatever somewhere. And it didn't work. I walked back to my dad in my clothes and went back to sleep. And he woke up the next morning. They were just staring at me, and I'm clothed with my down jacket on and my shoes. And he's looked, I don't know what he thought. I haven't asked him. And finally, I stumbled across, I don't know if it's still the same night, but it's a Thursday night meeting here. The group is called Primary Purpose Group. Someone in that group gave me a CD, and I put it I was listening to it in the car. I was driving back to my dad's. Like one of those commercials, are you tired? Are you strung out? Has life really got beaten you over the head? And I thought, is this an antidepressant commercial? But finally it said, he started talking about the spiritual malady. And I thought, in the jug. That, we stop that. The spiritual malady continues to grow. It doesn't go away unless you address it. And I kept going back to that Thursday night meeting, and I said, I want to hear about the spiritual malady because I've got it. And I went to the Veterans Center up in Fresno, and I heard Speaker David Marquez. And he talked about and treated alcoholism. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. I put the plug in the jug, and I'm untreated. And it was spiritual malady. I cannot tell you how relieved I was. And I knew it. My gut was telling me it's a spiritual malady. From then on, I got a sponsor that knew what that was. Would help me with that. And for me, when I landed in that room on Thursday night, that was when the noose was off my neck. And I hung in there, and there's someone in this room that got me going on that. And we read together, and highlighted the book together. The book in a way that this isn't about Bill and Bob, it's about Jeanette. And so I went through and I highlighted everywhere. And this person said, why don't you start with yellow? Because yellow is bright and happy and it represents hope. So I did. Anywhere where there was a solution, a promise, anything that I could look up to. If I worked this program, experienced it, and I mean the steps, and I did. Anything that I had experienced was probably in green, and like, yeah, that's me, was in blue. And I really started anchoring myself in this. Going, okay, I understand this. And we would talk about the spiritual nature. And I learned that the first 164 pages of the book are so vital to understand and stick with. For me, it was absolutely my lifeline. At that time, I put away my self-help books, all the other how-tos, and I'm not saying those are bad. I'm saying that's where I was. I was over here, I was back here in the stories, which are good, but for me, these people back here in the back of this book got here because they did what's on page 59 and 60 of your big book. And they combed through this and they stuck to it. And they kept up their spiritual program on a daily basis. And and they surrender. They let go of self-reliance and self-control. I was a control freak. I would tell my dad's oranges how when to grow. It was that bad. So I could see things. I could finally see hope. That's what it took for me. I also had another group that I went to on Saturdays called the Rainbow Group, and they were absolutely amazing. Take me in, take me to things, take me up to Springville. Okay, I got that name right. And they're over here for my family, family here in front. And so I was able, with the help of my higher power, whom I call God, to create a balance of just being rigorously honest and just chewing this stuff up, and then going and hearing other speakers, pancake breakfast meetings, and my life began to take shape. But it wasn't the old life I had. And when they say this is a lifestyle, you're in it. And that's good. And it takes time. But you can do it. With your higher power and working the steps. I had an amazing sponsor that took me through the steps. So I didn't stop at step 4 or 5 and then want to kill myself this time. It's like, no, I want to go. I want to tell other people about the spiritual promises that come true in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had some really huge promises happen. I'd like to share with you a couple. I'm going to take us quickly through the steps because I want to tell you some highlights that helped me. If it helps one person in this room, that's great. If not, for the moment, maybe planting a seed. I first have to say that I would always cringe in meetings when they would start how it works, and then they go to, there are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. I have anxiety and depression. Huge. I thought, I don't know if I'll make it. I'm one of those people. But many of them do recover, listen to this, if they have the capacity to be honest. Honest. I really had to get honest and let go and follow my sponsor. So she took me through and she said, Jeanette, at the top of 59, half measures will avail you nothing. You can't half-ass this program. I stood at a turning point. I asked my higher power for protection and care with complete abandon. I could let go. Surrender. And here's something that was very enlightened to me. Did you know the first step has two parts? We admitted we are powerless over alcohol. Hey, I got that. I went to rehab. Got it down. She said, no, Jeanette, listen, that our lives had become unmanageable. Mine was very unmanageable. It was crazy and it was insane. It was like, I think you put that in there. No, this book was written in 1939. It's been there. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I said, I want sanity. I don't do insanity. Nope. Then she said, okay, who's your higher power? And I said, oh, I became a Christian at 15. Okay. Is that the same, so who do you worship? Myself? No. Doorknobs don't work either, Jeanette. What she did was so helpful. She goes, I want you to go through the book and circle anything that has to do with a reference to a higher power. It could be creative genius, creative intelligence, a newfound friend. And I went, I circled. She goes, this is about 2 weeks, and I'll know when you get it. I'll see it in your eyes. So I did. I circled every reference, and she said, I want you to list them, pick the top two, and just sit with it. Be with yourself. Don't go out and be with friends unless you call me if you need something. So I thought, oh my gosh, did nothing? Not be in control? I settled on newfound friend because to me that's something I can take everywhere. and it's not up here, it's in here. I walked in and she said, you've got it. I was like, oh. Those are the biggest hurdles right there for me. Newfound friend is my higher power, also calling God. We went on to step four with my inventory, and I thought, oh, there is nothing more to write about. I can't tell you how many times she says, we're going to write. So I wrote, and I realized, oh, there's another side of this. It's not like, oh, these people did this to me. It's where did I get the ball rolling? And it's like, oh my gosh. And she helped me look for patterns of my life of how I had created and set up my own self-destruction that started to blow and I was 35 years old. I looked at my character defects. That was fun. For about 2 weeks, it's like every character defect I had came out. I was like, I'm not jealous. I don't envy people. You know, Alpha, and I was jealous and envying people. And it's just, she kept hanging in there with me and taking notes and got to the amends part. She's so funny. She made something that seems so scary where you have to go and tell people, you know, here's what I did. I want to make amends, keep my sobriety and my spirituality. She said, make 3 piles. I could do this. Hell no, and maybe. I said, I think I'll start with I can do this. And the ones with the hell no, I thought, oh, thank God. I thought maybe she was going to make me start with those. Like, if you're a really rigorous and dedicated, go all lengths, she'll go. She was wise. I didn't get to that hell no pile till there was one left, and that person came to me. I thought I was in a control when this happened. The final huge, horrible amends that I had to face came to me and apologized to me. And I was like, wait a minute, that's not what it says here. Listen to my script. Let go and let it happen to them. And we just went through. And I learned how to meditate a little bit, but I try every day somehow to have daily conscious contact with God. And I learned that over time I would get kind of an intuition, sort of a gut feeling about things, or whether it's work takes a problem through the steps. I am powerless over my teenage daughter, who seems unmanageable. And just walk all that through and give her over to God, my higher power, anything. My ailing father, who I almost like had a heart attack over myself, but I walk it through the steps. And I realized that I can't put a timeline on how fast to do this program for me. Because when the higher power, when you finally decide when the higher power is going to enter into your being and what that looks like, and you're ready to trust yourself with that, or trust the higher power, I mean, and to step off the seat of shame, there's so much shame around the wreckage that we cause, and to face that, just to forgive yourself. And I had to do a lot of that. And there's a lot of ego I had to get around, because I was an ego chaser. I didn't start smoking pot when I was 10. I was smoking my ego. Puffed on that thing, nourished it. It got me through some really dysfunctional family patterns, but later in life it didn't. So I just want to say that they say keep coming back. I am really glad that I was able to come back. But keep searching for the solution is in here. And find a sponsor who will stick with you and help you so they can see it in your eyes. And when they say one day at a time, it's one day at a time, and you build, and before you know it, a month has gone by, 6 weeks, 2 months, that's a big deal. And you're either in it or you're not. And that's the last thing I want to share is my sponsor said to me, Jeanette, you really got to decide, is your higher power, is the higher power all it or not? There's no gray area. When you get it and you hang in there, and congratulations, this is your first 2 hours of not drinking. I know what that feels like. But I'm telling you, from someone who almost killed herself, you don't have to go down that path. There's hope. It's in here. It's with your spiritual program. Spiritual malady can be conquered. Yeah. All right? Thank you.
All right, let's give another hand to Jeanette.
All right, one more.